Wasn't that a bit excessive? She thought of times when she'd been watching a movie with Nick and had fallen asleep halfway through with her head on his lap. She hated it because she would wake up sticky-mouthed to see the lives of the movie characters had moved on and the couple who hated each other were now sharing an umbrella under the Eiffel Tower. "You had your baby," she said tentatively to herself. "Remember?" This was absurd. Surely she wasn't about to slap herself on the side of the head and say, "Oh, the baby! Of course I had the baby! Fancy that slipping my mind!" How could she have forgotten her baby growing and kicking and rolling inside her? If she'd already had the baby, that meant she'd already been to prenatal classes with Nick. It meant she'd bought her first maternity clothes. It meant they'd painted the nursery. It meant they'd been shopping for a crib and a pram and nappies and a stroller and a changing table. It meant there was a baby. She sat up, her hands pressed to her stomach. So where was it? Who was looking after it? Who was feeding it? This was far bigger than a normal, "Oh, Alice," mix-up. This was huge. This was terrifying. Oh, for God's sake, where was Nick? Actually, she was going to be just a bit snappy with him when he finally turned up, even if he did have a good excuse. The nurse with the green eyes came back into the room and said, "How are you feeling?" "Fine, thank you," Alice said automatically. "Do you remember why you're here and what happened to you?" This constant re-asking of questions was presumably to check her mental state. Alice thought about yelling, "Actually, I am going out of my mind!" But she didn't want to make the nurse feel uncomfortable. Crazy behavior made people feel awkward. Instead, she said to the nurse, "Can you tell me what year it is?" She spoke quickly in case the doctor with the glasses came back in and caught her checking up on her facts behind her back. "It's 2008. It's definitely 2008. It's definitely 2nd of May, 2008. Mother's Day next weekend." Mother's Day? It would be Alice's first ever Mother's Day. Except if it was 2008, it wasn't her first Mother's Day at all. If it was 2008, the Sultana was 10 years old. He wasn't a Sultana at all. He would have progressed from Sultana to Raisin, to Peach, to Tennis Ball, to Basketball, to Baby. Alice felt an inappropriate gale of laughter catch in her throat. Her baby was 10 years old. Elizabeth's homework for Dr. Hodges. Much to Lila's horror, I stopped halfway through visualizing the prospect and switched over to the Idea Olympics. I'm sure you'll be fascinated to hear, Dr. Hodges, that this is the part where I get them to look under their tables and find their mystery product. Everyone gets pretty excited about this and they dive under the tables. It's amazing how so many different people can come out with exactly the same jokes. It reinforces this feeling I have that the years are rolling by, but nothing is changing. I am the perfect example of the phrase, going nowhere fast. While all my students were writing down ideas on butcher paper for how to market their mystery products, I tried to call Jane back. Only, of course, now Jane had switched off her phone, so I loudly said fuck it and saw Lila give a tiny, tight smile. I had offended her by changing the agenda, as if the agenda didn't matter, when the agenda is her life. I explained to her that my sister had been in an accident, and I didn't know what hospital she was at, and I needed somebody to pick up her kids from school. Lila said, "Okay, but when are you going to finish the rest of the visualizing the prospect segment?" I guess that sort of dedication is good in an employee, but isn't it a bit pathological, Dr. Hodges? What's your expert opinion? I called Mum next and got a voicemail too. Oh, for the days before Mum got a life. It seems only a short time ago that I would have called Franny first. She was always so calm in a crisis. But Franny decided to stop driving when she moved into the retirement village. I still find that weirdly upsetting. She was such a good driver. I called the school and got put on hold listening to a recorded message about family values. I called Alice's gym to find out if they knew which hospital she'd been taken to and got put on hold listening to a message about sensible nutrition. Finally, I called my husband Ben. He answered on the first ring, listened to me babble, and said, "I'll take care of it." "Look, Grey's Anatomy starts in 10 minutes. This journal writing must not impact on my nightly television gorge." I don't care what Ben says. Without the narcotic effects of TV, I might have gone truly insane a long time ago. Chapter 4. Apparently, Alice's CT scan was unremarkable, which made her feel ashamed of her mediocrity. It reminded her of her school reports with every single box ticked, satisfactory, and comments like, a quiet student, needs to contribute more in class. They may as well have just come right out and written across the front, so boring, we don't actually know who she is. Elizabeth's reports had some boxes ticked, outstanding, and others ticked, below standard. And comments like, can be a little disruptive. Alice had yearned to be a little disruptive, but she couldn't work out how you got started. We're concerned about your memory loss, so we're going to keep you overnight for observation, said the doctor with the red plastic glasses. Oh, okay, thank you. Alice self-consciously smoothed her hair back, imagining a row of doctors and nurses with clipboards sitting next to her bed, watching her sleep. She sometimes snored. The doctor hugged her and clipboard to her chest and looked at her brightly, as if she felt like a chat. Oh, gosh. Alice searched around for interesting topics of conversation and finally said, so did you ring my obstetrician, Dr. Chapel? Of course you might not have had the chance. She didn't want the doctor to snarl. Sorry, I was busy saving somebody's life. The doctor looked thoughtful. I did, actually. It seems Sam Chapel retired 3 years ago. Alice couldn't believe that Dr. Chapel was no longer sitting in his big leather chair, carefully noting down answers to his courteous questions in beautiful copperplate writing on white index cards. She really needed to get this problem sorted out once and for all. Pronto! Quick sticks! As Franny would say. Was Franny still alive in 2008? Grandmother's died. It was to be expected. You weren't even allowed to be that upset about it. Please don't let Franny have died. Please don't let anyone have died. Nobody else in our family will die, Elizabeth had promised when she was 10 and Alice was 9, because it wouldn't be fair. Alice had believed every single word Elizabeth had said when they were little. Maybe Elizabeth had died, or Nick, or Mum, or the baby. I'm sorry, but there is no heartbeat. For the first time in years, Alice had that feeling she used to get when she was little, after their dad died, that someone else she loved was about to die. She longed to gather everybody she loved and stow them safely under her bed with her favorite dolls. Sometimes the stress would become so overwhelming she would forget how to breathe, and Elizabeth would have to bring her a brown paper bag to breathe into. I might need a bag, Alice said to the doctor. A bag? Ridiculous. She wasn't a child who hyperventilated at the thought of people dying. I had a bag, she said to the doctor. A red backpack with stickers on it. Do you know what happened to it? The doctor looked vaguely irritated by this administrative question, but then she said, oh yes, over here. Would you like it? She picked up the strange backpack from a shelf at the side of the room, and Alice looked at it apprehensively. The doctor handed it to her and said, well, you just rest up, and someone will be along to take you up to a ward soon. I'm sorry there's so much waiting. That's hospitals for you. She gave her a motherly pat on the shoulder and quickly left the room, suddenly in a hurry, as if she'd remembered another patient who was waiting. Alice ran her fingers over the 3 shiny dinosaur stickers on the flap of the backpack. They each had speech bubbles saying either, dinosaurs rule, or dinosaurs rock. She looked down at the sticker on her shirt and peeled it off. It was a definite match. She stuck it back on her shirt. She felt that she should for some reason, and waited for a feeling or a memory. Did these belong to the Sultana? Her mind skittered away from the idea like a frightened animal. She didn't want to know. She didn't want a ready-grown baby. She wanted her own little future baby back. This could not be happening to her. But it is, so get a grip, Alice. She began to open the bag, and her fingernails caught her attention. She held up her hands in front of her. Her nails were beautifully shaped and long and painted a very pale beige color. Normally they were ragged and broken and rimmed with dirt from gardening or painting or whatever other renovation job they were doing at the time. The only other time they'd look like that was for her wedding when she'd got her manicure. She spent the whole honeymoon flapping her hands at Nick, saying, "Look, I'm a lady." Apart from that, her hands still look like her hands. Actually, they look quite nice. They were bare, she noticed. No jewelry. It was a little unusual that she wasn't at least wearing her wedding ring, but perhaps she'd been in a rush when she was getting ready for her spin class. She held up her left hand and saw that there was a thin white indentation from her wedding ring that hadn't been there before. It gave her a disconnected feeling, like when she'd seen the feathery marks on her stomach. Her mind thought everything was still the same, but her body was telling her that time had marched on without her. Time. She put her hands to her face. If she was supposedly sending out invitations to her 40th birthday party, if she was 39, she mentally choked and gasped for air at the thought, then her face must be different. Older. There was a mirror over a basin in the front corner of the room. She could see the reflection of her feet in their short white socks. One of the flurry of nurses had taken off the strange sneakers, chunky rubbery things, and put them on the floor next to the bed. Alice could just hop out of the bed and walk over and look at herself. Presumably it was against strict hospital regulations to get out of bed. She had a head injury. She might faint and hit her head again. Nobody had told her not to get out of bed, but they probably thought it was obvious. She should look in the mirror, but she didn't want to see. She didn't want to know. She didn't want this to be real. Besides, she was busy at the moment. She had to look through the bag. Quickly she undid the buckles of the backpack and shoved her hand in. She pulled out a towel. A plain, innocuous, clean blue bath towel. Alice looked at it and felt nothing but embarrassment. She was fossicking through somebody else's private stuff. Jane Turner had obviously picked up someone else's bag and insisted it was hers without really looking at it. It was just like Jane, so bossy and impatient. Well, Alice examined her beautifully manicured fingernails again. She put her hand in the bag again and pulled out a plastic bag, folded flat. She opened it and emptied it onto her lap. A woman's clothes. Underwear, a red dress, a cream-colored cardigan with a single large wooden button, knee-high beige boots, small jewelry case. The underwear was creamy lace-edged satin. Alice's underwear tended to be flippant and faded, jolly seahorses on her pants and purple cotton bras that clipped at the front. She held the dress up in front of her and saw that it was beautiful. A simple design of silky fabric with tiny cream flowers. The cream of the cardigan matched the cream of the flowers on the dress exactly. She checked the label on the dress. An S for small. It wouldn't fit her. She was a medium at best. It couldn't be hers. She folded the clothes back up and opened the jewelry case, lifting out a fine gold necklace with a big topaz stone. The stone was too big for her taste, but she dangled it over the dress and agreed that it was an excellent match. Well done, whoever you are. The other piece of jewelry was Alice's gold Tiffany charm bracelet. Alice said, "Fancy meeting you here." She picked up the bracelet and laid it across her wrist and felt comforted, as if Nick had finally arrived. Nick had bought this bracelet for her the day after they found out she was pregnant with the Sultana. He shouldn't have spent that much because they were experiencing what Nick called severe fiscal stress due to the fact that every single thing they did to the house ended up costing more than planned. But Nick said it could go on the balance sheet under extraordinary items, whatever that meant, because it was extraordinary that they were having a baby. The Sultana had been conceived on a Wednesday night, which just didn't seem exciting enough a night for such a momentous event, and the sex hadn't even been that passionate or romantic. It was just that there had been nothing much on TV, and Nick had yawned and said, "We should paint the hallway." And Alice had said, "Oh, let's just have sex." And Nick had yawned again and said, "Okay." And then they'd discovered there weren't any condoms in the chest of drawers next to the bed. But by then, the action was underway, and neither of them could be bothered to get up and find one in the bathroom. And besides which, it was a Wednesday, and it was only once, and, well, they were married. They were allowed to get pregnant, so therefore it wasn't really likely. The next day, Alice discovered there actually had been a condom in the back of the drawer, if she'd bothered to stretch her fingers just a bit further, but by then it was too late. the Sultana had already started doing what it needed to do to become a person. The day after they did 8 positive pregnancy tests, just in case the first 7 were wrong, Nick had come home from work and handed her a small gift-wrapped box with a card that said, "For the mother of my child," and inside was the bracelet. To be honest, she loved that bracelet even more than she loved her engagement ring. Of course, to be really honest, she didn't actually love her engagement ring at all. She sort of hated it. Not a single person in the world knew this. It was her only real secret, so it was a pity it wasn't juicier. The ring was an Edwardian antique that had belonged to Nick's grandmother. Alice had never met Granny Love, but she had apparently been formidable but adorable. She sounded dreadful. Nick's 4 sisters, whom Nick called the Flakes, because of their undeniably flaky tendencies, were crazy about that ring, and there had been a lot of bitter remarks when Granny Love left the ring to Nick in her will. One or another of the Flakes was always grabbing Alice's left hand and sniffing, "You just can't get jewelry like that anymore." Alice thought it was ugly. It was a big emerald set in the middle of a cluster of diamonds to look like a flower. It reminded her of a hibiscus for some reason, and she'd never been a fan of the hibiscus. But what did she know? Because every other girl in the world seemed to think the ring was divine, and apparently it was worth a small fortune. And that was the other problem. This was the most expensive piece of jewelry Alice had ever owned, and Alice lost things. Constantly. She was always retracing her steps, emptying out garbage bins and calling up train stations, restaurants and grocery stores to see if they had her purse or her sunglasses or her umbrella. "Oh, no," said Elizabeth when she heard that Alice's ring was an irreplaceable family heirloom. "You'll just have to, I don't know, get it surgically attached to your finger?" Most of the time, except for special events or if she was seeing the Flakes, Alice just didn't wear the ring. She wore her plain gold wedding band or nothing at all. She'd never really been a jewelry sort of person anyway. However, she loved the gold Tiffany bracelet. Unlike the ring, it seemed to represent all the wonderful things that had happened over the last few years. Nick, the baby, the house. Now she fastened the bracelet around her wrist, laid her head back against the white hospital pillow, and held the backpack close to her stomach. The thought crossed her mind that there were probably a million bracelets just like this one around, and it could just as easily belong to somebody else. It wasn't like she recognized anything else in the bag, but she knew it was hers. She was starting to get angry with herself. Come on now, remember. Furious, she shoved her hand back in the rucksack and pulled out a black purse. It was a long, luxurious rectangle of black leather. Alice turned it back and forth in her hands. "Gucci," it said, in tiny discreet letters. Goodness. She opened the purse, and the first thing she saw was her own face staring back at her from a driver's license. Her own face, her own name, her own address. Well, here was the proof that the bag belonged to her. The photo was typically blurry, but she could see she was wearing a white shirt and what looked like long black beads. Long beads? Had she become the sort of person who wore long beads? Her hair was cut in a bob just above her shoulders, and it seemed to have been colored very blonde. She'd cut her hair. Nick had once made her promise to never cut her hair. Alice had thought that exquisitely romantic, although Elizabeth had made gagging sounds when she told her and said, "You can't promise to still have a 14-year-old's hairstyle when you're 40. When you're 40. Oh. Alice put her hand up to the back of her head. She'd been vaguely aware that her hair was pulled back in a ponytail before. She hadn't realized that it was actually more of a pigtail. She pulled out the elastic band and ran her fingers through her hair. It was even shorter than in the driver's license photograph. She wondered if Nick liked it. In a minute, she would have to be brave and face herself in the mirror. Of course, she was still pretty busy at the moment. No hurry. She put the license back in the wallet and began to rifle through it. There were various credit and ATM cards with her name embossed on the front, including a gold American Express card. Wasn't a gold Amex just a status symbol for the sort of person who drives a BMW? Library card, health fund card. A plain white business card for a Michael Boyle, registered physiotherapist. The address was in Melbourne. She flipped it over and saw a handwritten message on the back. Alice. We're all settled and doing okay. I think of you often and happy at times. Call any time. M. XXX. She dropped the card in her lap. What did this Michael Boyle mean when he presumptuously referred to happier times? She didn't want to have had happier times with a physiotherapist in Melbourne. He sounded awful. She imagined a balding, paunchy type with soft hands and moist lips. Where the bloody hell was Nick? Perhaps Jane had forgotten to call him. She'd been acting so strangely at the gym. Alice should just phone him herself and explain that this was pretty serious and she really needed him to leave work right now. Why hadn't she thought of that before? Suddenly she was desperate to get herself a phone and hear Nick's lovely, familiar voice. She had a strange feeling as if it had been ages since she'd spoken to him. She looked feverishly around the small room and, of course, there was no phone. There was nothing in the room at all except for the basin, the mirror, and a sign about how to wash your hands correctly. A mobile phone. That's what she needed. She'd only recently gotten her first one. It was an old one belonging to Nick's father, and it worked fine, except that it had to be held together with an elastic band. Something told her that she would probably have a more expensive phone by now, and when she opened the zippered pocket at the front of the bag, she saw she was right. There was a tiny, sleek, shiny, silver phone sitting right there, as if she'd known it would be. Had she? She couldn't tell. There was also a leather-bound day planner, which Alice opened quickly, just to confirm that it was indeed 2008, noting with sick wonder that her own handwriting filled the pages. 2008. It said, in no doubt about it, black letters at the top of each page. 2008, 2008, 2008. She stopped flipping the pages and picked up the shiny phone, breathing shallowly as if a huge metal bar had been plonked across her chest. Could she even work this strange phone? She was hopeless at working out how to use new appliances, but her elegantly manicured fingers seemed to know what to do, pushing the silver buttons on either side of the phone so it snapped open. She punched in the number for Nick's direct line and held the phone up to her ear. It rang. Please answer. Please answer. She felt like she would burst into sobs of relief at the sound of his voice. Hello, sales department. It was a young girl's voice, frothy with good humor. Someone in the background was roaring with laughter. Alice said, Is Nick there at the moment? Nick Love? There was a slight pause. When the girl spoke again, she sounded as though she had just been sternly reprimanded. The laughter in the background stopped abruptly. I'm sorry, you've come through to the wrong extension, but I could put you through to Mr. Love's personal assistant if you like. Alice paused, diverted by the fact that Nick had a personal assistant. How posh. The girl continued as if Alice had argued with her. Mr. Love is actually in Portugal this week, so his PA would be the best person to help you. Portugal, she said. What's he doing in Portugal? Well, it's some sort of international conference, I think, said the girl uncertainly. But if I could just put you through... Portugal and a personal assistant? He must have got a promotion. They'd have to have champagne. Alice said cunningly, could you remind me of Mr. Love's position with the company? He's our general manager, said the girl in an everyone-in-the-world-knows-that tone. Good grief. Nick had the motherfucking Megatron's job. That was more than one promotion. That was a giant superhero leap up the corporate ladder. Alice was filled with giggly pride at the thought of Nick strutting about the office telling people what to do. Wouldn't people just laugh at him? I'm putting you through to his PA now, said the girl firmly. The phone clicked and began to ring again. Another female voice answered smoothly. Mr. Love's office, this is Annabel. How can I help you? Oh, said Alice. This is Nick's wife, Mr. Love's wife. I was trying to get a hold of him, but, The woman's voice turned razor sharp. Hello, Alice. How are you today? Well, actually, as you're aware, Nick isn't back in Sydney until Sunday morning. Obviously, if there's something that absolutely can't wait, I can try to get a message through to him, but I'd really prefer not to disturb him. His schedule is frantic. Oh, why was this woman being so mean? She obviously knew her. What could Alice have done to make her dislike her so much? So can it wait or not, Alice? She wasn't imagining it. This was real, live hatred she was hearing. The pain in Alice's head got worse. She wanted to say, "Hey, lady, I am in hospital. I came here in an ambulance." "I wish you wouldn't let people stomp all over you," Elizabeth was always telling her. Sometimes, long after Alice had forgotten the incident, Elizabeth would say, "I was up all last night thinking about what that woman in the chemist said to you. I can't believe you just took it. You've got no backbone." Alice would drop to the floor all jelly-like to demonstrate her lack of backbone, and Elizabeth would say, "Oh, for God's sake." The problem was, Alice needed more warning when it came to being assertive. These sorts of situations were so unexpected. She needed hours to really think things through. Were they really being nasty, or was she just being sensitive? What if they'd just found out they had a terminal disease that morning and were entitled to be in a bad mood? She was about to mumble something pleading and pathetic to Nick's PA when, against her will, her body began an unfamiliar sequence of actions. Her back straightened, her chin lifted, her stomach muscles clenched. She spoke and didn't recognize her own voice. It was taut and tart and decidedly snooty. "No, it can't wait," she said. "It is urgent. There has been an accident. Please ask Nick to call me as soon as possible." Alice couldn't have been more surprised if she'd found herself doing a triple backflip. The woman answered, "Fine, Alice. I'll see what I can do." Her contempt was still palpable. "I'd appreciate it." Alice hung up and said, with the phone still to her ear, "Cow, bitch, slut." She spat the words out of the side of her mouth like poisonous pellets. She swallowed. Now that was even more surprising. She sounded like a tattooed girl who quite liked the occasional catfight. The mobile rang in her hand, making her jump. It must be Nick, she thought, awash with relief. Once again, her fingers knew what to do. She pressed the button with the green phone symbol and said, "Nick?" A child's voice she'd never heard before said crossly, "Mom?" Chapter 5. Franny's letter to Phil. Dearest Phil, I'm a little riled up today. You'll remember I mentioned I'd taken on the role of running the social committee. Well, for the last few months I've been arranging a family talent night. It's next Wednesday. Children, grandchildren and so forth will be performing a variety of acts. Should be a fun night. In all honesty, it will probably be excruciating, but it will be a diversion from our arthritis, if nothing else. I was thinking today about the musical we organized together. Oklahoma, 1973? You kissed me backstage, and that sly little Frank Neary caught us. The news spread like wildfire. Mr. Peyton and Miss Jeffrey are a couple. The school principal and the math coordinator. Ooh, scandal. It just made everything even more delicious, didn't it? Anyway, today we had a new resident turn up at the social committee meeting. I can't recall his name. See? Shocking memory. I'll call him Mr. Moustache, because that's his most defining feature. A comically large white moustache. It gives him the look of a retired used car salesman, or perhaps a seedy Santa Claus. Anyway, Mr. Moustache was full of suggestions. We're serving tea, coffee, sandwiches, pikelets and scones on the family talent night. Standard fare for a function at a retirement village. Mr. Moustache piped up and suggested we set up a cocktail bar. Said he once spent a year bartending on some Caribbean island and that he could make a cocktail guaranteed to blow my socks off. I'm not joking, Phil. This is the way he talks. I tried to explain about liquor licenses, but he was already on to a new topic. He said he knew a young girl who wasn't exactly a family member, but would she still be allowed to perform? Of course, I said. He said that was wonderful because she did a very entertaining pole dancing act. All the men slapped their knees, roaring with laughter. You wouldn't have laughed, would you? Even some of the women were laughing. Rita was laughing like a loon. She has dementia, so I guess I can excuse her. But still, you'd think she'd retain a modicum of decency. It was the strangest thing. I felt the most absurdly embarrassing desire to burst into tears. All at once, I was straight back in my very first classroom out of teacher's college. There was a very handsome boy in my class. I can still see where he sat, second row from the back, who was always cracking jokes and making everyone laugh. Did I ever tell you about him? He made me feel so humorless and stodgy, like an old maid. And I was 20 years old, for heaven's sake. You never made me feel... Barb just phoned. Alice has had a nasty fall during her gym class. She seems to spend half her life at that gym, and she's in hospital. I'm in a fluster. I'll finish this later. Mom! The child spoke again impatiently. Alice couldn't tell if it was a boy or a girl. It was just an average kid's voice. Breathy, rushed, a touch snuffly. Kind of adorable. She hardly ever spoke to children on the phone, except for the occasional stilted birthday chat with one of Nick's nephews or nieces, and she was always struck by the sweetness of their kid-like voices. They seemed so much bigger and scarier and dirtier in the flesh. Her hand was sweaty. She took a firm grip of the phone, licked her lips, and said hoarsely, "Hello?" "Mom, it's me!" The kid's voice bubbled up out of the phone as if he or she were yelling straight in her ear. "Why, did you think it would be Dad? Is he calling you from Portugal? Oh, if you speak to him, can you please tell him that the name of the Xbox game I want is Lost Planet Extreme Condition, okay? Got it? 'Cause I think I told him the wrong name. Okay, Mum, this is pretty important, so you might need to write this down. Do you want me to talk slowly? Lost Planet Extreme Condition. Anyway, where are you? We've got swimming and you know I hate being late because I get stuck with a stupid paddleboard. Ah, there's Uncle Ben. Is he taking us swimming today? Okay, cool. Why didn't you tell us? Hi, Uncle Ben. Okay, gotta go. See you, Mum. There was a scraping sound, a thud, and the sounds of children shouting in the distance. A man's voice said, "G'day, champ," and then the line was cut off. Alice dropped the phone in her lap and stared straight ahead at the open doorway. Had she just had a conversation with the Sultana? She didn't even know the baby's name. They were still arguing over names. Nick wanted Tom, a good, honest name for a man. And Alice wanted Ethan, a sexy, successful name. Or if the Sultana surprised them by being a girl, Alice wanted Madeline, and Nick wanted Addison, because apparently girls didn't need good, honest names. Alice thought, I could not be mother to a child and not know his name. This is simply not possible. It is beyond the realms of possibility. Maybe it was a wrong number. The child had mentioned an Uncle Ben. There was no Ben in Alice's family. She didn't know a single Ben. She wasn't sure she'd ever even met a Ben. She searched her mind and all she could dredge up was a huge, bearded, neon sign designer she'd once met while helping Nick's older sister, Dora, possibly the flakiest of the flakes, at her psychic arts shop. And in fact, his name could just as easily have been Bill or Brad. The problem was that the kid had asked, "Why, did you think it would be Dad?" when she had said Nick. Also, he knew Nick was in Portugal. It was beyond the realms of possibility. Yet, on the other hand, it seemed sort of conclusive. She closed her eyes briefly and opened them again, trying to visualize a 10-year-old son. How tall would he be? What color eyes? What color hair? Part of her wanted to scream with the sheer terror of the situation, and part of her wanted to roar with laughter because it was so ridiculous. An impossible joke. A hilarious story she would be telling for years. And then I ring Nick, and this woman tells me he's in Portugal. And I'm thinking, Portugal? She picked up the phone gingerly as if it were an explosive device and considered calling somebody else. Elizabeth. Mum? Franny? No. She didn't want any more strange voices telling her things she didn't know about the people she loved. Her body felt weak and heavy. She would do nothing. Nothing at all. Eventually something would happen. Somebody would come. The doctors would fix her head and everything would be okay. She began shoving things back into the rucksack. As she picked up the leather-bound diary, a photo fell out. It was a photo of three children in school uniforms. It was obviously a posed shot because they were sitting in a row on a step with their elbows on their knees and their chins in their hands. There were two girls and a boy. The boy was in the middle. He had messy, white blonde hair, ears that stuck out, and a turned-up nose. He had tipped his head to one side and clenched his teeth together in a grotesque grimace that Alice knew was meant to be a smile. She knew this because she must have seen at least 100 photos of her sister pulling an identical face. "Why do I do that?" Elizabeth would say sadly when she saw the photo. On the boy's left side was a girl who looked older. She was a chunky, stolid-looking girl with a long face and straight brown hair and a ponytail that had fallen over one shoulder. She was slumped forward in a way that clearly said, "I do not want to sit in this ridiculous position." Her mouth was compressed in a straight line, and she was looking grimly off to the right of the camera. She had a nasty graze on one chunky knee, and both her shoelaces were undone. There was nothing remotely familiar about her. To the boy's right was a little girl, with blonde curls bunched together in fat pigtails on either side of her head. She was smiling ecstatically, with a dimple denting her cherubic cheeks. There was something stuck to both the shirt collars of her uniform. Alice held the photo up closer. There were shiny dinosaur stickers, just like the one on Alice's own shirt. Alice turned the photo over and saw there was a typewritten label stuck to the back. It said, "Children, left to right. Olivia Love, kindergarten. Tom Love, year 4B. Madison Love, year 5M. Parent, Alice Love. Number of copies ordered, 4. Alice turned the photo back over and looked again at the three children. "I have never seen you before in my life." There was a distant buzzing sound in her ears. She could feel herself breathing short, shallow breaths, her chest rising and falling quickly as if she were at high altitude. "Oh, it was so funny. So I'm looking at this photo, right, of three kids, and it's my own children. And I don't even recognize them. Hilarious." Another nurse Alice hadn't seen before came into the room, glanced briefly at Alice, and picked up the clipboard at the end of her stretcher. "I'm so sorry we're still keeping you waiting. The powers that be assure me it should only be a few more minutes, and we'll have a bed free for you. How are you feeling?" Alice put crazily trembling fingertips to her head. "The thing is, I don't actually remember the last 10 years of my life." There was a quiver of hysteria in her voice. "I think we might try and organize a nice cup of tea and sandwiches for you." The nurse looked at the photo lying in Alice's lap and said, "Your kids?" "Apparently," said Alice, and gave a little laugh that turned into a sob. And the taste of tears in her mouth felt so familiar, and the thought came into her head, "Stop it. I'm so sick, sick, sick of crying." But what did that mean? Because she hadn't cried like this since she was little. And anyway, she couldn't stop even if she wanted. Chapter 6. Elizabeth's homework for Dr. Hodges. In the afternoon tea break, I called Ben on his mobile, and he said, over a babble of noise that sounded like 20 kids, not 3, that he'd picked up the children from school and he was driving them to their swimming lessons now. He said he'd been informed it was impossible to miss even one swimming lesson because Olivia had just become a crocodile or a platypus or something, and I heard Olivia's gurgling laugh as she shouted, "A dolphin, silly Billy!" I could also hear Tom, who must have been in the front next to Ben, saying monotonously, "You are now 5 kilometers over the speed limit. You are now 4 kilometers over the speed limit. You are now 2 kilometers under the speed limit." Ben sounded stressed but happy, happier than I've heard him in weeks. Picking up the children and driving them to swimming is not something Alice would normally ask, trust us to do, and I knew that Ben was probably exhilarated by the responsibility. I imagined how people glancing over at traffic lights would see a standard dad, maybe a bit bigger and bushier than average, with his 3 kids. If I think too much about this, it will hurt a great deal, so I won't. Ben told me that Tom had just spoken on the mobile to Alice and according to Tom, she didn't say anything about falling over at the gym, and she sounded just like Mum, except maybe 10 to 15% grumpier than usual. I think he's learning percentages at school right now. Weirdly, I'd never even thought about just ringing Alice's mobile myself, so I immediately dialed the number. When she answered, she sounded so strange that I didn't recognize her voice and thought that a nurse must have picked up the phone. I said, "Oh, sorry, I was just trying to reach Alice Love." And then I realized it was Alice, and she was sobbing. "Oh, Libby, thank God it's you." She sounded terrible, hysterical, really, babbling about a photo and dinosaur stickers and a red dress that couldn't possibly fit her but was really beautiful, and being deliriously drunk in a gym, and why was Nick in Portugal, and she didn't know if she was pregnant or not, and she thought it was 1998, but everybody else said it was 2008. It gave me a fright. I can't remember when I last saw or heard Alice cry, or call me Libby. Even though she has had so much to cry about over the past year, she doesn't cry in front of me, and there's such a horrible polite restraint in all our conversations recently, with both of us putting on these oh-so-reasonable voices. It actually felt sort of good to hear Alice cry. It felt real. It's been such a long time since she needed me, and that used to be such an important part of my identity, being the big sister who shielded Alice from the world. I should save my money and analyze myself, Dr. Hodges. So I told her not to worry, that I was coming straight there and we would sort everything out. And I went straight back on stage and said there had been a family emergency and that I had to leave, but that my very capable assistant Lila would be taking over. And when I looked at Lila to see her reaction, she was pink and radiant, as if she'd just got religion. So that was okay. Of course, the hospital would have to be Royal North Shore. I always feel as though I've swallowed something huge when I drive into that car park. It's shaped like an anchor, this thing I've swallowed, and it goes straight down my throat and stretches out on either side of my belly. Another thing, the sky always seems so huge, like a big empty shell. Why is that? I must always look up as I'm driving in. Or maybe it's something to do with me feeling tiny and useless. Or maybe it's just simple geography, for heaven's sake, and the road goes up before it dips down into the car park. I'm here for Alice, I reminded myself when I got out of the car. But everywhere I looked, I could see old versions of Ben and me. We haunt the place. If you ever go there, Dr. Hodges, keep an eye out for us. There we'll be, shuffling down the pathway along the side of the hospital, back toward the car park on a sunny, ice-cold day. Me in that unflattering hippie skirt that I keep wearing because it doesn't need ironing. And I'm holding Ben's hand, letting him lead me, looking at the ground and chanting my mantra. Don't think about it, don't think about it, don't think about it. You'll see us standing at the reception desk, filling in forms, and Ben is close behind me, rubbing my lower back in tiny circles. And I feel like the circles are somehow keeping me breathing. In, out, like a ventilator. There we are, squashed into the back of a lift with an excited family, their arms overflowing with flowers, and "It's a girl!" balloons. We both have our arms wrapped protectively around our stomachs in exactly the same way, as if we're hugging ourselves close, so all that joy can't hurt us. You told me the other week that this doesn't define me, but it does, Dr. Hodges. It just does. As I walked along the echoey corridors, clop, clop, clop went my heels. And the smell! Well, you probably know that horrible boiled potato smell, Dr. Hodges. The way it floods your sinuses with memories of every other hospital visit. I ignored the badly dressed ghosts of hospital visits past and concentrated on Alice and wondered if she was still thinking it was 1998. And if so, what that would be like. The only thing I could compare it to was the one time when I was a teenager and got horribly drunk at a 21st party and stood up and gave a long, loving toast to the birthday boy, whom I had never met before that night. The next day, I didn't remember a thing about it. Nothing. Not even shadowy snippets. Apparently, I used the word paucity in my speech, and that disturbed me, because I didn't think my sober self had ever said that word out loud before, and I wasn't even entirely sure what it meant. I never got drunk like that again. I'm too much of a control freak to have other people falling about laughing while they describe my own actions to me. If I couldn't stand losing 2 hours of my memory, what would it be like to lose 10 years? As I looked for Alice's ward number, I had a sudden memory of Mum and Franny and me, giddy with excitement, just like that family in the lift, practically running through the corridors of another hospital looking for Alice's room when Madison was born. We happened to see Nick in the distance, walking along ahead of us, and we all shrieked, "Nick!" And he turned around, and while he waited for us to catch up, he ran around in circles on the spot and did a two-fisted punch in the air like Rocky, and Franny said fondly, "He's such a card." And I was dating that patronizing town planner at the time, and I decided right then and there to break up with him, because Franny would never call him a card. If Alice had really lost every memory of the last 10 years, I thought then she would have no memory of that day, or of Madison as a baby. She wouldn't remember how we all shared a tin of Quality Street's chocolates while the pediatrician came in to check Madison. He flipped her this way and that, and held her in one palm with casual expertise, like a basketballer spinning a ball. And Alice and Nick blurted out in unison, "Careful!" And we all laughed, and the pediatrician smiled and said, "Your daughter gets 10 out of 10, an A+. We all applauded and woohooed Madison for her first ever good mark, while he wrapped her back up in her white blanket, a neat packet of fish and chips, and ceremoniously presented her to Alice. I was just starting to consider the enormity of all the things that had happened to Alice over the last 10 years when I found her ward number. And as I glanced through the door, I saw her in the first curtained-off cubicle propped up against pillows, her hands resting on her lap and her eyes staring straight ahead. There was no color to her. She was wearing a white hospital gown, lying against a white pillow with a white gauze bandage wrapped around her head, and even her face was dead white. It was strange to see her so still. Alice is all about sharp, quick movement. She's texting on her mobile, jangling her car keys, grabbing one of the kids by the elbow and saying something stern in their ear. She's fingernail tapping, busy, busy, busy. 10 years ago, she was nothing like that. She and Nick slept till noon every Sunday morning. "How will they ever find time to renovate that enormous house?" clucked Mum and Franny and me like elderly aunts. She didn't see me at first, and as I walked up to her, her eyes flickered, and they looked so big and blue in her pale face. But more importantly, she was looking at me in a different but familiar way. I don't know how to describe it, except that the strange thought came into my head. "You're back." "You want to know the first thing she said to me, Dr. Hodges?" She said, "Oh, Libby, what happened to you?" I told you. It defines me. Alice had finally been moved up to a ward and given a hospital gown and a remote for the television and a white chest of drawers. A lady wheeling a trolley brought her a cup of wheat tea and 4 tiny triangular curried egg sandwiches. The nurse was right. The tea and sandwiches had made her feel better, except they hadn't done anything about the huge gaping crevasse in her memory. When she heard Elizabeth's voice on the mobile phone, it was just like each time she'd called home on that disastrous trip around Europe when she was 19, and trying to pretend she had a different personality, an adventurous, extroverted sort of personality, the sort of person who loves exploring cathedrals and ruins all day on her own, and talking to drunk boys from Brisbane in youth hostels at night, when really she was homesick and lonely and often bored, and couldn't make head or tail of the train timetables. The sound of Elizabeth's voice, loud and clear in a strange phone box on the other side of the world, always made Alice's knees buckle with relief. And she'd press her forehead against the glass and think, "That's right, I am a real person." "My sister is coming right now," she told the nurse when she hung up, as if giving her credentials as a proper person with a family she recognized. Although when Elizabeth first walked toward her bed, she actually didn't recognize her. She vaguely assumed that this woman in the cream suit with the glasses and the swinging shoulder-length hair must be a hospital administrator coming to do something administrative. But then something about the woman's straight-backed, "I'll-take-you-on" posture, something essentially Elizabeth, gave her away. It was a shock because it seemed that overnight Elizabeth had put on a lot of weight. She'd always had a strong, lithe, athletic-looking body because of her rowing and her jogging and whatever else it was she was always so busy doing. Now she wasn't fat, but definitely larger, softer and bustier, a puffed-out version of herself, as if someone had blown her up like a plastic pool toy. She won't like that, thought Alice. Elizabeth had always been so amusingly moralistic about fattening food, refusing an offer of pavlova as if it were crack cocaine. Once, when Nick, Alice and Elizabeth went away for a weekend together, Elizabeth spent ages at the breakfast table studying the nutritional information panel on the side of a container of yogurt, warning them darkly, "You have to be really careful with yogurt." Whenever Nick and Alice ate yogurt after that, one of them would always shout, "Careful!" As she got closer, and the bright light over Alice's bed lit up her face, Alice saw fine spidery lines etched around Elizabeth's mouth and on either side of her eyes, behind the elegant spectacles. Elizabeth had large pale blue eyes with dark lashes, like Alice, inherited from their father. Eyes that attracted compliments, but now they seemed smaller and paler, as if the color had begun to wash out. There was something bruised and weary and worn out about those washed-out eyes, as if she'd just been badly defeated in a fight she'd expected to win. Alice felt a surge of worry. Something terrible must have happened. But when she asked, Elizabeth said, "What do you mean what happened to me?" So briskly and spiritedly that Alice doubted herself. Elizabeth pulled over a plastic chair and sat down. Alice caught a glimpse of her skirt pulling unflatteringly across her stomach and quickly looked away. It made her want to cry. Elizabeth said, "You're the one in hospital. The question is, what happened to you?" Alice felt herself slip into the role of irrepressible, hopeless Alice. "It's completely bizarre. It's like a dream. Apparently, I fell over at the gym. Me at the gym. I know. According to Jane Turner, I was doing something called my Friday spin class." She could be silly now, because Elizabeth was here to be sensible. Elizabeth stared at her with such grim, frightened concentration that Alice felt her silly grin drift away. She reached out for the photo she'd left sitting on the chest of drawers next to her bed and handed it to Elizabeth, saying in a small, polite voice, "Are these my..." She felt more foolish than she'd ever felt in her life. "Are these my children?" Elizabeth took the photo, glanced at it, and something complicated crossed her face, a barely perceptible tremor, and vanished. She smiled carefully and said, "Yes, Alice." Alice took a deep, shaky breath and closed her eyes. "I've never seen them before." She heard Elizabeth take a deep breath herself. "It's just temporary, I'm sure. You probably just need to rest, to relax, and... what are they like?" Alice opened her eyes. "Those children. Are they... nice?" Elizabeth said in a stronger voice, "They're wonderful, Alice." Alice said, "Am I a good mother? Do I look after them all right? What do I feed them? They're so big." "Your children are your life, Alice," said Elizabeth. "You'll remember for yourself soon. It will all come back. Just..." "I could cook them sausages, I guess," said Alice, cheering up at the thought. "Kids love sausages." Elizabeth stared. "You would never feed them sausages." "I thought I was pregnant," said Alice. "But they did a blood test and told me I'm definitely not. I don't feel like I am, but I can't believe I'm not. I can't believe it." "No. Well, I don't think you would be pregnant." "Three kids," said Alice. "We're only going to have two." "Olivia was an accident," said Elizabeth stiffly, as if she disapproved. "None of this seems real," said Alice. "I'm like Alice in Wonderland." "Remember how much I hated that book? Because nothing made sense? You didn't like it either. We like things to make sense." "I can imagine it must feel really strange, but it's not going to last. It's all going to come back to you any minute. You must have hit your head quite severely." "Yes, very severely." Alice picked up the photo again. "So this little girl is the oldest, so she must be my first baby, right? So we had a girl? Yes, you did. We thought it was a boy. I remember that. And labor. I went through labor 3 times. What was my labor like? I'm so nervous about it. I mean, I was. I think you had a pretty easy time with Madison, but there were complications with Olivia. Elizabeth fidgeted in her plastic seat. Look, Alice, I think I should go and try to talk to one of your doctors. I'm finding this really hard. It's weird. It's really scary. Alice reached out for Elizabeth's arm in a panic. She couldn't stand to be alone again. No, no, don't go. Someone will be around soon. They keep coming and checking on me. Hey, Libby, I called Nick at work and they told me he was in Portugal. Portugal? What's he doing there? I left a message with some horrible secretary. I stood up to her. You'd be proud of me. I showed backbone. My backbone was like steel. Good for you, said Elizabeth. She looked as if she'd just eaten something that disagreed with her. But he still hasn't called me back, sighed Alice. Elizabeth's homework for Dr. Hodges. It was only when she started talking about Nick being in Portugal that the obvious hit me, and it seemed even more shocking than when she asked me whether her children were nice. She really has forgotten everything. Even Gina. Chapter 7. So you seriously don't remember anything, not a single thing since 1998? Elizabeth shifted the plastic chair in closer toward Alice's bed and leaned toward her, as if it was time to get to the bottom of this. Nothing at all. Well, I've been having some funny snippets of things come into my mind, said Alice, but none of them make sense. Okay, so tell me about them, urged Elizabeth. Her face was closer now to Alice, and the lines on either side of her mouth were even deeper than Alice had first thought. Goodness. Involuntarily, Alice pressed her fingertips to her own skin. She still hadn't looked at herself in a mirror. She said, Well, when I first woke up, I was having this dream, and I couldn't tell if it was just a dream or something that really happened. I was swimming, and it was a beautiful summer's morning, and my toenails were all painted different colors. There was somebody else with me, and their toenails were painted the same way. Hey, maybe the other person was you. I bet it was you. Elizabeth said, No, that doesn't mean anything to me. What else? Alice thought about the bouquets of pink balloons bobbing about in the gray sky, but she didn't want to tell Elizabeth about that great tidal wave of grief that kept sweeping her away, and she wasn't all that keen on finding out what it meant. Instead, she said, I remember an American lady saying, I'm sorry, but there is no heartbeat. Oh, said Elizabeth. Elizabeth's homework for Dr. Hodges. I admit I found it oddly touching, flattering even, that of all the billions of memories significant enough to float to the surface of Alice's mind, that was one of them. Alice has always been good at imitating accents, and she did that woman's voice perfectly. The tone and the rhythm were exactly the way I remembered, and for a moment I was back there in that gloomy room trying to understand. I haven't thought about it in such a long time. Imagine, Dr. Hodges, if I could travel back in time to that day and whisper in my ear, This is only the beginning, honey. Then I'd throw back my head and laugh a demented witchy laugh. Actually, you don't really like it when I do that sort of black, bitter humor thing, do you? I've noticed that you smile politely and sort of sadly, as if I'm making a fool of myself, and you know exactly why, as if I'm a teenager who isn't in control of her own embarrassing emotions. Anyway, I didn't want to talk about the American woman to Alice, obviously. Especially not to Alice. I don't especially want to talk about it with you either. Or think about it, or write about it. It just happened. Like everything else. Elizabeth smoothed the white blanket next to Alice's leg with the flat of her palm. Her face seemed to harden. She said, Sorry, that doesn't mean anything to me either. Not a thing. Why did she sound angry? Alice felt as if she'd done something wrong but couldn't work out what. She felt stupidly clumsy, like a child trying to grasp something big and important that the grown-ups weren't telling her. Elizabeth met Alice's eyes and gave her a half-smile and looked away again quickly. A woman carrying flowers came into the ward, peered hopefully at Alice and Elizabeth, blinked dismissively, and walked past their curtained-off cubicle to the next one. They heard a disembodied voice squeal, "I was just thinking about you!"